And now I want to meditate for a bit upon that hymn. Beginning at the very beginning, where's this question, what shall I do, my God, to love? He would just love to be able to embrace and express the love of God adequately. But as you and I discover every week, it simply cannot be done. We lift our hearts towards God, of course we do, but not far enough. And then in verse 2 he sings, your sovereign love extends to all, immense and unconfined. The love of God is like spilt ink. Some of you will remember the nightmares of spilling ink. Spilt ink gets absolutely everywhere. You simply cannot stop it. It is like the love of God. It's unconfinable. It flows on. And as Charles Wesley says here, enfolding humankind. Or as he originally wrote, enfolding all mankind. But we can't say mankind these days. All humankind. It's that word, all, that he wants. The love of God doesn't reach out and enfold some people. Or even many people. Or even most people. The love of God reaches out to absolutely all. I've met people, struggled with people. At one stage, I was one of those people who feared that they would never, ever be loved the way that they yearned to be loved, that they would never be enfolded the way most people are. Isn't that word enfolded wonderful? How did he think of that? These poor souls like me, they were resigned to living, or even worse, in some cases, not living without it. Not most, all of humankind. And then in verse 3, Charles Wesley reveals his personal involvement in this. The love of God, he says, is so wide it never passed by one, or it had passed by me. If there was one person who was going to be left out of the love of God, then surely that person would have been me. And for him, that is startlingly personal and self-revealing. Are you inclined to think, oh, come on, those Wesley boys were fine. All this miserable sinner stuff is just hymn writers' crocodile tears for the likes of you and me. I don't think I buy that. There's plenty to suggest that there was much in the Wesley boys, much in what they got up to, particularly when they were at Oxford with the young ladies of their social class. Plenty to suggest that there's a good deal for them to be ashamed of. Not to mention how, when they were missionaries in Georgia together, John notoriously had to flee home because of a scandal involving one of the young wives of the colony. We can all fantasize, of course, but I understand that line in verse 4. My trespass was grown up to heaven. I understand that to mean that whatever Charles had been up to with the ladies or whatever, he knew it could not possibly have escaped the notice of heaven. And to put it mildly, he felt bad. In fact, thinking about the words Charles chooses for this hymn, and especially that wonderful word enfolding, I have the feeling that apart from everything else, he was quite simply lonely, wild escapades in Oxford notwithstanding. When you read about the early days, you find precious little there about personal friendship. No warmth, and certainly, Oxford ladies apart, no enfolding. And so often when men get it disastrously wrong with women, all they're really looking for in their ham-fisted way is warmth and affection. Ask any street worker. They know. And in case you're wondering, yes, I have. Ask them, I mean. But it's not just a male problem. Still less is it just a young male problem. Far too many people, surely far too many elderly people, know the sheer heart-crushing ache of loneliness. The young, the elderly, all those in between, we're none of us immune. And it seems to me that seen in that context, Charles's discovery that God's compassionate love was so wide it never passed by one, or it had passed by me, it becomes a cry of personal relief and joy and wonder. Because of this experience, Charles revisited the scriptures and realized that he was experiencing what it was, what it is, to meet Jesus face to face. Think Mary Magdalene, blind Bartimaeus, the Syrophoenician woman, Zacchaeus. The list goes on. And remember how Zacchaeus cried, "Now has salvation come to this house." I think that is the sheer elation of discovering that there is a place for you after all. That, I believe, is what Charles Wesley discovered, and a few days later, so too did his brother John. So wide it never passed by one, or it had passed by me. And the simple message that they took the length and breadth of Britain and to the Americas was, if me, then surely you too. And that final verse, come quickly, gracious Lord, and take possession of your own. This hymn is not just an 18th century thing. It's a today thing. Surely to be possessed and enfolded by love is the sweetest thing in the world. what we all want. And it's not for some. It's not for many. It's not for some time in your past, but not now. It's for all. And it's for now. Let's then go back to the remark of St. Paul in Romans 15 that I picked out. Therefore, welcome one another as Christ has welcomed you for the glory of God. How should we welcome one another? We should we not, welcome one another as God welcomed Charles Wesley, with a love as immense and as unconfined and as enfolding as we can possibly muster. And if you grant me that, the next question is, whom should we welcome? Whom should we welcome? As I prepared for this morning, I found getting to this point relatively straightforward, because I spent a lot of my life singing and thinking about the hymns of Charles Wesley. I found getting beyond this point quite tricky. And to help me do that, let me introduce another word. In St. John's Gospel, Jesus calls his disciples his friends. I expect I've told you before that I often say to people at weddings and funerals, especially when I'm milling around afterwards asking people who they are, I say to them, don't say, I'm just a friend. Because I do recognise that there are occasions when I'm just a friend is a very important remark. And we all hope it's true. But laying those awkward moments aside, compare I'm just a friend with saying I'm just adopted. You cringe, don't you? You don't want to hear someone say that. Our daughter Ruth was telling Margaret and me day before yesterday, about her friend who, with her husband, after years of disappointment, they adopted 2 small children about a year ago. And Ruth told us that she and her friend were collecting their children from the nursery, and a little voice called out, oh, there's my mummy. And Ruth says her friend absolutely melted for joy. Not, there's my adopted mummy. Heaven forbid. There's my mummy. Well, every single friend there has ever been has been an adopted friend. But you'd never say that. They are friends, and that's why they're so precious. And that is why Jesus calls his disciples his friends. So my question, St. Paul's question, becomes, whom should we receive as friends? Which brings us back to Grumpy's problem. Does Christianity make special demands of friendship upon us? I think it does. It's quite straightforward to say of our church community, this is a place of Christian friendship where everyone can have and be friends on equal terms. If that much isn't true, then we're all wasting our time here this morning. Thankfully, it is true. Of course it is. The tricky bit is when we extend this beyond our church into our personal friendships. Do we have to do that? I've thought a lot about that this week, and yes, I think we do. Because if we don't, I fear that our church friendships are in danger of turning into a sham. In the normal way, personal friendship is built on give and take, on mutual generosity, and friendship struggles to survive when what ought to be give and take seems to have become all give from your side and all take from the other. I'm sure we've all been there. Our Ruth talks about her high maintenance friends. But there comes a point where the price is just too high. We none of us like being taken advantage of, and sometimes friends like that just have to go. But isn't there another sort of friendship where it might be thought with some truth that there's far more giving on one side than on the other, but where in this case the lopsidedness has nothing to do with one party taking advantage of the other? I'm thinking of friendships where both sides give what they can. It's just that one side simply has so much more to give than the other side. Remember Christina Rossetti at this time of year? What can I give him, poor as I am? If I were a shepherd, I would give a lamb. If I was a wise man, I would do my part. Yet, what can I give him? Of necessity, we have nothing to offer God except our hearts. That's all we have to give. But Rossetti expresses that about God. It's not just about God, is it? There are also people who, if we make room for them in our lives, we do so knowing that they have very little else to offer us except their hearts. And perhaps all this long rigmarole that you've been patiently listening to this morning adds up to no more than this. For us Christians, might it not be true that if we fill our lives with friendships that are fully reciprocal, whether those friends come to church with us or not, might it not be true that if we do that, we are not fully doing the job that Jesus asks us to do? Jesus makes room for us in his life, even though we have nothing to give. Maybe he asks us to do the same, to make room in our lives, not in our church, but in our lives, for people to become friends, to become real friends, who have very little to give in return except their love. Remember what Jesus says in John 15, verse 16. You did not choose me. I chose you.